The idea for this panel came from a story in the New York Times by Hiroki Tabushi back in November, and it was about the need to replace pipes and the fact that there was going to be a war between people who manufactured the old traditional concrete pipes and the people selling new plastic pipes. And I thought that was pretty interesting because it talked about $300 billion in need to replace drinking water pipes in this country. That's not chump change. You know, that's more than a few F-35s. And some of the things that story talked about was that by 2020, the average age of like 1.6 million miles of pipeline would be 45 years old. And that there were some pipes that were 150 years old. I mean, you start looking at these numbers, they're kind of crazy. $300 billion in cost, pipes that are this old. That led me to Andrew Welton from Purdue over here, who has written and talked about the plastic versus the concrete pipe battle, if you want to call it that. And then I myself spent a few years working for county government, and that taught me that there was probably no way for municipalities and county governments and regional governments to pay for this kind of stuff. And that led me to Janice over there from Michigan State. And that's what they're going to be talking about today. First, the manufacture of all these pipes and how it looks like it's going to go. And even a better and bigger question for journalists, which is one that even if from the smallest paper to the biggest paper, you would, or TV station or whatever, you're going to be writing and talking about the costs associated with infrastructure. And when you think about it, and I'll shut up in a second, when you think about it, you got public health, you got education, you got roads and bridges, you've got a lot of different pools of money that need to get paid from, that, you know, that there are bond issues for, there's different pots of money that the public is being asked to pay for. Where do pipes and water infrastructure fit? Probably pretty close to the bottom, because you know that public safety is going to come first, and some of these others will as well. So, Andrew, if you want to introduce yourself and say who you are and where you're from and what you do and get us going, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you. Here or?
Here or there.
I'll stand next to the mic here.
Yeah, take the podium.
Okay. So for those of you in the room, yes.
They use the mic to record it. Right. It's not for the people in the room.
Okay. Yeah. So thank you for coming. And first, thanks, Neil, for the invitation and talking with me. This is going to be great. I know Dr. Beecher, we've worked together before, and she's brilliant in what she does, so don't leave, okay? Stay here. as somebody starts getting up. I'm Andy Welton. I'm a Purdue University professor. 4 years ago in New Orleans, I went to SEJ at the recommendation of Ken Ward, if any of you have the pleasure of knowing Ken. I met him in West Virginia during the West Virginia chemical spill, because my university team was from Alabama, and we were the crazy people that drove 12 hours into West Virginia and had discovered that a lot of what was being told by the state and the federal agencies to the people just wasn't true based on testing we did. So anyway, so I'm back, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. My expertise primarily has been civil engineering, environmental engineering. I worked for the U.S. Army for 3.5 years. I worked for engineering consulting firms that were looking at buried piping and figuring out what the best thing is for municipalities to do about it. And I can tell you, I went back to pursue a PhD in civil environmental engineering because I saw plastics as being an issue. When I was in the engineering consulting firms, they were choosing plastics for replacing buried ductile iron pipe, ductile concrete pipe, and it was failing, and it looked like Swiss cheese, and it had these cracks in it. And the engineer said, well, plastics were a lot cheaper, they're a lot easier to handle, and we can get the job done faster, so let's use that. And many of the municipalities were choosing to do that. But in the last 10 years, we've stumbled upon some issues that really need to be questioned in communities across the country. So I'm going to get to this, but I just want you to have this mental image in your head. There's a pipe, sewer pipe being repaired at this location. This was actually on Purdue University's campus. These are pipe repair contractors that are there. Okay, and so keep that in the back of your mind. So you've probably heard somebody quote some ungodly amount of money that's needed to repair and replace pipes. There's numbers from the Environmental Protection Agency, American Society of Civil Engineers, ASCE, the American Water Works Association, all sorts of different organizations are just giving these very high numbers for what it would financially take to fix our nation's infrastructure. And here's some additional numbers. So public sewer pipes in the United States, you know, about 0.8 million miles of them exist, and 1 million miles of drinking water pipes. But what is often not talked about is inside the building. So there's about 5 to 10 times the length of pipe inside the building than there is in our buried infrastructure, okay? And those also are aging, corroding, and failing and require replacement. I have some pictures up here. These are called storm sewer or stormwater culvert pipes. These are the types of pipes that go underneath your road. This is corrugated steel. And as you'll see, the bottom on some of them is just missing. What happens is when water, you know, goes over metal for a very long time, corrosion happens, it dissolves the metal, and you can have basically the pipes collapse on themselves. And that is what we're trying to prevent. We're trying to prevent acute public safety risks here with our buried infrastructure, not collapsing, pipes collapsing on themselves, the contamination, being allowed to fester inside the pipes and make their way to people. Or when you have collapsed pipes, you're now sometimes unable to do firefighting and other types of activities that support public need. So there's about 40% of the existing buried infrastructure needs to be replaced. And many of it is long past due, as Neil mentioned. And to just give you a kind of a primer, for a drinking water system, and a lot of us know now what the difference is between private premise plumbing, and premise is defined as property. Okay, so there's building plumbing, there's premise plumbing, and then there's water distribution systems. And so water distribution systems are the buried pipes beneath the streets, the drinking water pipes. There's generally a service connection for larger systems. And then you have a service line, a very small diameter service line that carries water to the building where there is a water meter and maybe a backflow preventer. And this could be a house, a school, an office building. And as Neil mentioned too, a lot of the infrastructure for at least drinking water systems that exist today is steel, cast iron, and ductile iron, and reinforced concrete. And all these materials are basically past their service life. What I mean by that is when they were initially put in, The manufacturers were claiming that these will last at least 50 years. Well, a lot of them are way past 50 years, but they're still being operated. Okay. So a lot of these need to be replaced.
What's the word Luddite mean? Seventh one down, under joint
type. Joint type. I'm not familiar with that type of joint, so I can't answer that question right now, but I can look it up after and get back to you if you contact me. So this was about 3 years ago. I did a presentation, and I talked about the fact that plastics are kind of displacing the legacy infrastructure materials. What I mean by that is they're displacing, taking the place of concrete. They're taking the place of iron. And there is, in fact, as Hikuro Tabuchi mentioned, there is a war going on underneath your feet. And you may or may not know it, but you're financing it because we're paying rates. We're paying tax money that's being used to make decisions about what types of pipes will be purchased by communities. Okay. So what we have here is plastics are replacing materials, and we have concrete, fiber-reinforced plastics. These are things called FRPs. Anybody ever been on a boat? Right? Boats are plastic. That's a fiber-reinforced plastic. So plastics are now infusing into our infrastructure, high-density polyethylene, PVC pipe, and some others. And this was 11 years ago, the EPA estimated $200 billion. More recent estimates are $300 billion and $400 billion. And hopefully, if you're looking for a type of story, you should go to your local utility and ask them if they've taken out a pipe recently that maybe was really interesting to them. And they may find something like this. This would be a tuberculated, this is galvanized steel pipe. But what happens is this used to be, a lot of surface area. And what happened was because of corrosion, we had tuberculation happen. So the iron basically came out of the material and then precipitated on the surface, and it shut it down. One of the issues here is surface area. So if you're trying to prevent things from growing in your pipes, which is something we want to do, you need to have very smooth surfaces so that the water can scoop by. It will shear off any materials to the degree that you want. When you have something like this, you have different velocity gradients, you have possibly different temperatures, and you have spaces where biofilms and organisms and pathogens can kind of hide. So this year, there was a study, I believe, conducted by the University of Illinois, and they identified Legionella in an actual water distribution system. Okay. So historically, what's happened is people have assumed, well, Legionella is only a building issue. And I think that a study came out in Environmental Science and Technology Journal. I think it was either the letters or the journal itself. But that was a pretty important discovery. And so there are these organisms that can see distribution systems and also make their way into plumbing and kind of hide out in there. So replacing the pipes, not only just for a flow quantity issue, but also for drinking water safety. And the big question here is today, are they replacing them, ripping up the street and replacing them, or are they just going to fix them in place? And this is the way it used to be. This is not the way that your municipalities and cities and states are doing things really anymore. Okay, you'll see some of this, but probably the majority of their work is not this anymore. They're using what's called trenchless technologies. So trenchless technologies are technologies whereby you don't see this anymore. They access the buried pipe through one direction, and you'll see people kind of snaking in maybe a black plastic pipe into the ground, and it disappears, kind of like the cable companies that are snaking in new cables. And they'll only be there for a little bit. So what happens is you have, I-95, I-10, I-65. They don't have to dig up I-65. They can just snake this pipe inside the existing damaged pipe. They can create a new pipe in the ground, or they can drill right next to that pipe and put in a new one. And that is saves a lot of money, a lot of time, and it's almost out of sight, out of mind. The problem in all of these communities is that civil and environmental engineers who run your municipalities, who make decisions and run your transportation agencies, some of them are in politics, they are not trained on plastics, and that is the way that the industry is moving. So for years, even when I was in a design firm, they were using plastics because that's what we should do. They're trained on asphalt, steel, concrete, and wood design, water treatment, hydraulics. They are not trained on plastics. And that's a problem because what that means is they are now taking most of their information direct from the people that are selling products to justify that these are great products for all applications. And that's when you see things go awry. So there's a couple big misconceptions that I try to make clear to people, especially the general public. I hear it all the time. I got called last night at 10 o'clock from somebody in Texas who's replumbing their home and asked what pipe they should choose. I got called earlier in the week from somebody in Oregon who asked me what pipe they should choose, which one leaches the least, and their builder is going to use plastics. And so in both of those calls, people said, well, the EPA tests it and it's safe. So we're just determining which one is the safer. And then there's this other assumption that EPA transferred all its testing authority to the National Sanitation Foundation International. Both of those are false. Okay, so EPA, they're not like the Consumer Product Safety Commission where they test stuff to determine if it's safe or not. They don't certify it. And if you ever see an NSF symbol on a pipe, there's NSF.gov. That's a science agency that is a federal agency. That is not who's certifying the pipe. So NSF International, where they stamp things NSF, is a 501c nonprofit that has about a $200 million water programs budget. And they receive money from industry to do testing for them, to put their stamp on it, and then that goes out into the public domain. Okay? Some issues with that are the way that they test the products are inappropriate, in that they don't look for things that matter to the end user. Also, they only generally test one or two water types. They don't look at all conditions. And what's really amazing is that pipes will be installed, say in your bathroom or underneath the seat, and nobody's telling you that for 30 days or 12 days or here, 4 days, don't use the water, right? You assume that the pipe's installed and everything's okay. Well, don't use the water is how they test the pipes. And then after this don't use the water period, then they challenge that the chemicals that are in that water against EPA standards and Health Canada standards. But in practice, nobody does that. They install the pipe and then you start using it. And so that's one of the issues. And history has proven that product testing standards for plastics are deficient. How many people, by show of hands, know of polybutylene pipe, this gray pipe? Okay. Gray pipe, yeah. This was from my house in Alabama. So as I was buying a house in Alabama, we had it inspected, and the plumber called me up and said, don't worry about it, you have PVC pipe. And I said, what color is it? He said, gray. I'm like, that's drainage pipe. Then they plumbed the house with drainage pipe. So I said, send me a picture, and he sent this. This is polybutylene pipe. This is the class action $300 million lawsuit pipe that was installed across the country. And the homeowners at the time were trying to sell the house to us, and they had no knowledge that they had it in there. So what we did was, through negotiations and education, they ended up dropping their sale price, I think it was $9,000, to replumb the house that had this pipe in it. And the class action lawsuit recovery, for they could have had it for free, ended like 6 months earlier. So they could have, if they knew about it, they could have done something about it. Okay. So this still exists in people's homes. This right here, high-density polyethylene pipe, what happens is it was used for free chlorine applications. Sometimes there were catastrophic failures in American Samoa, as well as out west, there were catastrophic failures beneath the streets. I think it was out in Arizona, and it was because of the accelerated degradation of it and the interaction of disinfectants. There were some issues out in France, where a water company in France bought a whole bunch of small systems. They switched their systems to chlorine dioxide, and then the chlorine dioxide basically ate up those plastics. So the reason why that happened is because people making decisions about treatment and water safety don't understand the materials that they're dealing with. Okay. And then this pipe here, it's a copper pipe. It has epoxy coating in it, and what happens is they snake a tube in there and they spray epoxy around it because this copper had pinhole leaks. And this is a really bad job because you see the kind of slump at the bottom, and it basically all ran down the side of it. And then what happened over time is not only did it occlude the velocity so you could get pressure to the locations, but then it all came out in people's aerators and clogged out the appliances. So the issue with this is not only a manufacturing defect, but it's also an awareness issue for the people that are making the decisions, and it's also the applicators, the people that are installing these products. And so what I wanted to do is kind of give you a few emerging issues. And all of these are happening in your communities. These are all local stories, regional stories, and national stories. The first one is called curd-in-place pipe. By a show of hands, has anybody ever heard of this? Okay, so just a few of you. So curd-in-place pipe is an amazing technology where they take this sock, it's literally a sock made of fabric, and they saturate it with resin, and they put it and snake it through a manhole and then go underneath the street to the other manhole. So it's a sock, right? And then what you do is you blow air in and you inflate it. And it's sticking against the sides of the walls of the pipe, and then you pump steam in one side and it heats it. And that steaming process, that thermal process, causes this liquid plastic basically to harden. And so that's what that is right there. That is a cured-in-place pipe installed. Once it hardens, they come in with a saw and they cut one end, the other end, and then they get up and walk out. So the curing process could take 2 to 12 to 14 hours, depending on the thickness of that tube. But the fact is that you don't have to shut down roads. It's fast. What you see is these contractors hopping from manhole to manhole around communities. And this is happening across the country. It's $2.4 billion market, and 40% of that market is in the United States. So this is the process here. If you pump steam in, what happens is you have a sock. Anybody ever put water in a sock? Right? Stuff comes out. It's not like glass. And so that concept happens here. So stuff comes out on the side. Sometimes they take a ventilator and they pump it into the air. And the assumption has been for years that it's steam. Because you put steam in, therefore this white stuff comes out, it must be steam. So this is in downtown Philadelphia. This is what it looks like. It's happening all across the country. And one of the issues is that this emission, right, when they put the tube into a sewer pipe, the emission sometimes goes through the side of the pipe too, and then they'll go up the sewer laterals and into people's buildings. Okay. And so people will call the health department. Often they're given the letters, these door hangers that tells, don't talk to anybody, but talk to the contractor. So the contractors then interface with them and tell them it's okay. And it's happening across the country. So we know of at least 62 incidents that have happened. We talked to several utilities in our investigation. They said none of the incidents happened at their place, so we FOIA'd them. And we found out that quite a few incidents happened at their utilities. This incident here, San Diego, California, if you just search for this online, you'll see it. 36 kids were sickened at Zamorano Elementary School. One of them went to the hospital. The individual in Nyack, New York, had to get oxygen in his house. In Richmond, Virginia, there was an incident recently, and this is somebody called me from New York City, and these are the CIPP workers that he went and interviewed, and they're standing in the white, what they believe is steam. So this is in Alexandria, Virginia. This is a worker doing some measurements at the downstream plume, and what the people are being told is this. It's just styrene. It's only a few ppm. Everything's fine. Some people are offended by this, so don't worry. Just because you smell something doesn't mean it's toxic, and that's what we're being told. So there's no chemical capture, there's no setback distances, there's no respiratory protection program, and there's no air monitoring. And as it turns out, it is toxic. So in October of 2017, there was a tragic death of a 22-year-old sewer worker inside an installed CIPP. In Streamwood, Illinois. And OSHA, when this happened, we talked to OSHA, and OSHA took some information from us, then did blood analysis and found out that this individual had been exposed to at least 220 ppm of styrene, which is one of the chemicals that's present. And in May of 2017, we released a study warning that there's probably worker and public safety risks that were an issue. And in 2015, a University of New Orleans student actually discovered 1,000 ppm of styrene coming out of a manhole in the city of Los Angeles. Okay. So repairing infrastructure, and there are consequences to it, not just financial and not just clean water and repair. So we looked at the scientific literature and what does it say. We were funded by several state agencies and a federal agency, and what we're finding is that in Colorado, somebody in the plastic session was from Colorado, there was a repair gone wrong, and it contaminated actually the drinking water of a major ski resort, and the governor and the legislature got involved in that incident. In Alabama and Virginia, Vermont, there was an incident where a trout stream was contaminated. Oregon got involved as well. These circles here are known air contamination incidents that we know of that have happened. The stars are known water contaminations, and we probably know just the tip of the iceberg. So when we did testing, what we did was we set up a system, a stainless steel system, to suck up any of the material that was coming out because we wanted to see what's in the steam, and it's not steam. So what's really important for you to point out is this up here. So there's this floating liquid on the top, and then there's this mixture here. So this mixture here is water mixed with partially cured plastic. So they blow steam in, but they don't allow the plastic process sometimes to complete for things, so they blow it out. So the plastic, this partially cured oligomers, starts blowing out into the air, and that's part of what's coming up here. Okay. What's also coming up is this stuff at the top. That's pure organic solvent. Okay. That used to be in the blue uncured resin tube and was extracted by the process, the air as well as the water. Okay. And so that is what they're standing in, not steam. And we've done several other studies. It's not steam. So this is what's also there. So the industry has claimed 3.2 ppm is the highest known concentration of styrene in the air. They've cited that. They've given it to municipalities, probably where you live. They've given it to design engineers who work for those municipalities. And that is what has propagated itself into press releases that different organizations have put out. And so it's not just styrene. It's a number of different chemicals. And as we mentioned before, you know, there was one individual that we know of, bless you, that passed away due to exposures. We took the materials that we collected at five different sites we went to, and we have evidence that cell viability of mouse lung cells is impacted by the exposure. So we're currently working right now to determine what the scale of that could be and then how it translates to humans. So there's a website that you can download. It's all free information. We post everything and we pay for open access, so all the studies are free. Two other issues that I want to just touch on. One of them, they both have one slide each. Heavy metal accumulation on plastics. Okay, there's this theory that if I put plastic pipes in, everything's going to be okay for these heavy metals. Lead, copper, zinc, all these other things. And the fact of the matter is, metals actually can accumulate onto plastics. Not all plastics, but it's hydraulically driven, it's microbial driven, and it's chemically driven, as well as temperature. There's a new incident that happened with regards to polypropylene pipe and possibly PEX pipe. As it turns out, it was discovered recently that copper, when it's present at 0.1 milligram per liter, in drinking water systems, accelerates the degradation of plastic, of these plastics. And so there's been issues in Australia, there's been issues in Canada, and it really hasn't hit the US yet, but the same materials are used under the same conditions. Okay. Another issue is leaching from plastics, coatings, and composites. This is something that people are asking me about and concerned about. There is no clearinghouse for that information. And there's been relatively no public testing of it. So with that, I just wanted to end and pass it over to Neil.
Well, thank you for such encouraging words.
That's a discussion.
So, Janice, if you'd like to step up and tell us how much it costs to poison ourselves.
Yeah. I don't know if I'll be able to answer. What a downer, Andrew. So, first of all, thanks for having me. Thanks for the invitation. And thanks for holding this event in Flint. To those of us in Michigan, that does mean a lot to us. Thank you for your coverage of these issues. I don't think we say that enough, that those of us, Andrew and I, people like us, you know, it's always a little intimidating when you hear from a reporter, but it's also really gratifying to know that you care and that you're going to try to translate these issues to the public that are just so important. So my work's always a work in progress, and I'm just coming off a week-long training event of our own, so I'll try to get going here. Actually, Andrew's the brilliant one of the team. You know, this panel actually demonstrates how interdisciplinary this issue of water is, right? It really takes all kinds, and the field I'm in, which is mainly public utility regulation, more on the economic side, but I'm a big standards, as you know, I'm a big standards person too, so I'm always happy to hear about that. The other thing I should say that Andrew and I share a little gender moment getting ready for this panel, because I actually texted him and said, what are you wearing? You know, it's like a classic female thing, right? Because I knew he was going to wear jeans and a jacket. And women are always trying to find the equivalent, because I really wanted to wear jeans, but I was like, all right, I'll put real pants on today. You know, I know I could have. It's Saturday in Flint and with journalists. I thought, I can get away with that, right? But it was kind of cool, because I was like, Andrew, what are you wearing? I thought that was fun. So the other thing is, I would say that we're sort of bridging. I'm going to try to bridge. I don't know if I can really respond to what Andrew said, but from the earlier panel on human rights, which is so important, I kind of really wanted to be on that panel, because I see my work sort of centering on that, and I'll touch on that briefly. So yeah, I work on the non-controversial issues of water pricing, privatization, and regulation. Who cares? You know, nothing interesting going on there. I mentioned it briefly last. You know, so I am a political scientist. So what do I know from pipes or infrastructure, chemicals? Little. I failed that stuff really badly in school. But one of the things I've been, you know, I'm just one of the benefits of growing older in this field and working in it a long time is you get the chance to be on panels with people like Andrew, civil engineers of all kinds, economists and lawyers and all the people working hard on water issues, people like Eric Olson that we finally got to see each other after a couple decades. So one of the ways I think about water systems and that complicates them for us is that they actually deliver multiple products through one set of pipes. And we don't always differentiate our pricing systems, our policy systems around that. And what I was told by an engineer a long time ago is that, that's okay, I don't know. I'll fade in and out, that's okay. That water systems, in many ways, are designed, the specs are around putting out fires. And that's a big part of water systems. Yet we don't price it based on whether your house starts on fire, right? We price it according to usage. And we've gotten very, very focused, as I'll say later, on this enterprise model and full cost pricing model, and sometimes we forget the rest. The water is a human rights panel, you know, picked up on this, that, you know, we have water needs for our basic consumption, our personal hygiene, our home hygiene. You can certainly argue that those should be treated as rights, at least some basic level. And then we've got our more discretionary use. So you always have to parse that out, right? Because watering the lawn is not so much a human right. It doesn't have to be treated that way. By elastic, I mean, you know, are these uses going to be highly responsive to prices? Utilities generally aren't highly responsive to prices in the first place, not the basic usage. So you really want to focus pricing tools, management tools, efficiency-oriented pricing on the more discretionary uses. So I'll come back to that. So I'm not going to go into the details because I really want us to have some time for discussion, but I thought I'd highlight a couple things that I think I've learned over the years about properties of water supply and demand. It is distinctive. You know, our center at MSU works on energy issues as well, and we, electricity, gas, even telecom, which, by the way, you know, there's probably more clarity in universal service and the right to telecom and broadband than there is to water globally and in the U.S., which I think is an interesting issue itself. So water, you know, of course, is life-giving. It's the only product we physically ingest. It's a universal solvent. That's tearing up your pipes eventually, right? So it can be aggressive or corrosive. That was an issue here in Flint. It's abundant, renewable. I mean, compared to energy, water has amazing properties, right? It's storable. That's what we want for energy, because we can store renewable energy in a cost-effective impact away. That's the game changer. But it's also finite, variable, transient in time and space. Sources can be vulnerable for sure, prone to these increasingly sort of erratic behaviors with weather patterns. It does compete with other uses. It's heavy and incompressible. That's why we don't have giant water systems the way we have giant electricity systems, because pumping water across long distances, we have to even invest more. And plus, the stuff is just heavy. We hear a lot about scarcity. We're going to run out of water. Are we running out of water? I mean, not really. All the water ever on Earth is still on Earth. It just moves around. It's just sometimes, but Mother Nature's in charge. So we may not have the water when we need it, where we need it. We can have long stretches of, you know, where we're definitely having issues. But as I'll say at the end, issues of water, especially in the U.S., I regard as more issues of governance than of resources, technology, or even infrastructure. As long as you've got smart people working on this stuff, you can do it. But do you have standards in place to guard against the kinds of abuses you were talking about? Some properties of demand. Water use is just intrinsically connected with public health, sanitation, fire protection. We have to start to recognize that more explicitly. Our usage varies with all kinds of variables there, how we use water relates to how we design systems. Same with energy. And so things that we actually don't tolerate as much in energy anymore, like inefficient peaking and stuff, we allow for in water. We're perfectly comfortable allowing for these, patterns of inefficiency. At the same time, you know, we want to be careful not to like overdo it in the extreme, where, for example, we don't have that diversity of demand, and then we've got everybody paying for water over very, you know, low levels of usage. It's kind of a complicated story. Water for public supply is actually small slice compared to water use for irrigation or thermoelectric cooling. So when we talk about, again, the challenge of water withdrawals, we should be able to figure this out, and especially, again, since water is storable and we can use demand management techniques to help us through, you know, periods of lower availability. And I'll get to demand patterns in a minute. So just a few words about the structure of the water industry. The EPA, the US EPA, uses water systems as a regulatory unit. We also use the term water utilities. Those are not the same. So you'll hear about 50,000 water systems in the U.S. when in fact, a lot of those are actually more connected than we always recognize. So it is a fragmented industry, but it's also very bifurcated. We tend to see dominance by big municipal systems in the U.S. The systems are roughly divided between governmental and non-governmental ownership forms, and we're doing a really detailed census right now, starting with Michigan, but then hopefully working our way through the entire EPA database to try to have a more accurate picture, because, again, a lot of the mythology around the structure of the industry is not quite accurate. So we do have differences in size and ownership. Privatization came up in the last panel. There are some privately owned investor-owned water utilities. A lot of my work centers on regulation, economic regulation. In the case of a privately owned water utility, it has to be subject to regulation because it's a monopoly. And there's some interesting discussion now. In fact, I'm working on a small paper on it right now, on whether economic regulation should be extended to the public sector. In a case like Flint, where you had issues related to the pipeline, issues related to service and cost allocation, would economic regulation have made a difference? And I would say it probably would have, and it certainly should have. So we've got these structural issues. So in terms of bifurcation, this is what I'm talking about. Lots and lots of systems that serve very few people in the country, and then a concentrated number of systems, something like, 10% or, 80, 90% of the system served. So it's this is a challenge for setting standards, regulatory standards, right? Because you're trying to be protective of all people, all citizens, all children in the United States. So while water's not a human right, I would argue that compliant drinking water, complying with federal standards, is something that the law envisions, regardless of where a child is born. So here's just a picture, by the way, a snapshot of just how many, 1,385 systems in Michigan alone, varying sizes, and certainly opportunities there for some coordination, consolidation, but if it's economic, you see big gains. I didn't put it in here. You see big economic gains when you go from a little tiny system to even just a middle-sized system. Once you go to a middle-sized system to a really big system, it depends, you know, whether it'll be, you know, so you can't just, you don't assume unlimited economies. You know, those might fall off at some point, but there's certainly opportunities there. So a lot of work on regionalization going on. So here's the, finally getting, you know, some water infrastructure. You've heard the big numbers, big needs estimates. So my cautionary note about that is that these needs estimates, they're all big scary numbers, you know, $1 trillion, whatever. What I worry about is they're assuming in-kind replacement, right? And by the way, your cruddy pipe, that's a technical word, like your cruddy pipe, that also slows down energy, right? And has an, you need to add that to that one slide because I'm learning more about that, like that right? Because you have like this whole list, and like, because water uses energy. So here in the Midwest, we've got a lot of water, right? I mean, we've had way too much last week, that's for sure. So we could go out and we can find water, no problem. We conserve water, we use water wisely to save energy, partly to save energy in areas like ours. But what I'm concerned about, and you know, with Flint, Detroit. Big population loss on top of other trends in usage, efficiency gains. So why would we rebuild the system as is? That's nuts. We need to re-optimize our water system. So one of the things you can talk to when you call them up about their pipe replacement policies, ask them about what are you doing to re-optimize your systems? What technologies and tools are you using to analyze your system relative to trends in demand? In place, if you could do it safely, maybe a viable option in terms of a diameter reduction, right? You could still get the level of service that you want, but you've got to do it safely, is I think your message. So we want to guide decisions by public health priorities. I would argue, again, that we need to look at these numbers really carefully, not just take them for granted, not just take the big scary numbers for granted. I think we might be able to do better, and there are people who run models that actually can sort of demonstrate that on a case-by-case basis. Now, after the Flint crisis, I served on the infrastructure commission here for a year where we tried, and the big scary number we had was $4 billion for all infrastructure annually. But one issue I was constantly sort of nagging about was the difference between funding and financing. And so that's an idea I want to share today, too, because people will often say, let's try privatization. That'll be a great source of funding. Not really. There's two sources of funding. I've got two pockets, and so do you. You've got your taxpayer pocket, and you've got your ratepayer pocket. That's pretty much it. And the difference, as I'll get to in a second, is your ratepayer pocket, that's almost always a regressive amount, meaning it has a regressive impact. In other words, low-income families are going to pay more out of their pocket than a higher-income family. A tax instrument, on the other hand, could be more or less progressive. And I thought that's what you were driving toward, Eric, is that like maybe some things should be socialized. It's not a dirty word, but some things it's proper to spread those costs over a tax base, whether it's local or federal, state or federal. So in other words, there's just those two ways. Privatization, these other things, these are means of financing. And when you talk about alternative means of financing, you should talk about the cost of capital. So when you move to a private model, which some advocate, and that may be a viable option for some communities, but you've got to do it with your eyes open to talk about how that will be affected by the cost of capital, by income taxes. You know, private companies, they have to pay taxes. They have to get that return for investors and so on. So they're not the same thing. So keep that in mind. The last panel brought it home to me, too. You know, again, we've become almost obsessed with these ideas of enterprise. You know, the utility must operate as an enterprise, as a business, and we must price at full cost, almost to the point of punishing the customer. You know, you, Andrew, you're going to get a higher bill because of all those little kids you've got now. And so, it's almost become to that point where we're so focused on that. What do we forget about? We forget about public health. We forget about security. We forget about, you know, just sort of basic issues of rights and decency and so on. So I think while those things are important, and I'm I'm okay with efficiency. I think we also have to be, just be realistic. I wanted to mention, too, how many are from Michigan here? Okay, have you heard about, like, Bolt, Headley and Bolt as barriers? So, right? Okay, kind of hard to get your brain around, but it's almost like a rock and a hard place here because we have a constitutional amendment that makes it hard to raise taxes, and then we have a court case that makes it hard to raise user fees. So, you know, so here's the problem. Even when we have the resources and even when we have the need, we have this, again, this problem of political will of just paying for infrastructure. As taxpayers or ratepayers, the truth is we don't like to pay for anything. So going back to the discussion about, right, until we can, like, get over this, people ask, like, what can we do? Well, we have to elect people who are willing to work with us to raise taxes and fees in a way that's fair and reasonable so we can get good, safe infrastructure. And here's why. Because the payback is great. Healthier people, healthier families, healthier economies, right? So that's what we have to somehow have that conversation about it being a good investment. I won't go into this, but again, we're sitting in one of the few states that doesn't have regulatory jurisdiction for water on the economic regulatory side. There are other agencies and so on. It's a heavily regulated business from different angles. So this is more of the space I'm in, but we just don't have that authority here right now. So yes.
What was the deal with Wisconsin?
Okay, so Wisconsin is one of the only states, I should have mentioned that, like why were they called out there? They actually have comprehensive jurisdictions, so their utilities for both energy and water, their municipal utilities are subject to economic regulation, meaning that they have to go over to the state Public Service Commission and show them their financials and their rate plans for changing rates and so on. So it's considered, you know, it's sort of at the one extreme. There's a whole bunch of models for regulating the munis, but that one is very comprehensive, and it's fully accepted. It's part of their institutional culture. They don't really question it for the most part. So Indiana, they can choose to be regulated, and all the big cities do. So they, why? Because the rates go up, you can blame the state. Yeah, right?
Go back to that slide for a minute.
Pardon?
Go back to that slide.
Sure. So a few others have some form of authority over governmental, in other words, non-private systems. The private systems are pretty much regulated in every state if they have a presence. We only have 12 companies here we could classify as private companies here in Michigan, so there's not really a recognizable private presence here. There's one in the Upper Peninsula where the city approves the rates, for example. But I'd be glad to answer questions about that. So let me just show some slides about what we pay and pricing trends. So here's our utility bills. And oh, by the way, I put these up on our website every year and update them. So if you need, don't worry about taking pictures because I can give you a decent copy of this one. People grab these all the time. I'm perfectly fine with that. So this is just from the Bureau of Labor Statistics showing what we pay for utilities. You see we spend a lot on electricity, telecom, less on water. Now some of this is going to be hidden though. This is for a family of four. So some of these expenditures might be part of your rent, or you may pay zero or something, so it can, you know, like all averages, it masks big extremes, right? You get some economies when you join forces under one roof. But so for the water people, though, there's constantly sort of this comparison. Well, people have no trouble paying this big electric bill or telephone or cable bill, so why don't you want to pay your water bill? And it's kind of a sometimes I think it deteriorates to a level that I'm not really comfortable with. So here's our expenditures over time, and there's been a lot of discussion these days about water affordability, we do use different metrics, and those are debated because of imperfections in all metrics, but we keep water expenditures in the U.S., we've kept them between about 6 and 7%. We've gotten some relief because natural gas has been cheaper with shale gas development and all of that, and energy prices have been actually doing pretty well. So we keep it at that level. So people talk about, you know, what's affordable, 2%, 2.5%. Yeah.
Are those corrected for inflation?
No. So these are not, but these are percentages. So so in other words, I'm showing these as so percentage. You don't have to. So but intentionally, no, I didn't adjust these to real prices for this particular one. Yeah.
The percentages are percentages as using non inflation-corrected dollar.
Correct. So it's percentage of how much of our, so you don't really have, since it's a percentage, you don't have to worry about that as much, the percentage of your household expenditures that you're putting towards utilities.
But in standardized dollars, water would be going down as a fraction of household usage.
I'll get to that in a second. I'll try to help you with that. So remember I mentioned earlier about the regressive nature of utility bills, which is kind of a nerdy way to say it, obviously, but like as we go into higher income quintiles, we spend more on utilities. Makes sense, right? You get a bigger house, more stuff to plug in, et cetera, maybe that swimming pool or whatever. And then this is the important message, though, is by income quintile, low-income families spend a lot more on their utilities. This is obvious in a way, right? But it means that whenever people say, hey, let's finance that through utilities, right? And I get this a lot. Let's subsidize solar. Let's subsidize electric vehicle charging stations. Let's subsidize this. Let's subsidize that. Or let's try this new thing. You've just got to remember that absent a rate design response, you are going to be hitting low-income families. Even a program to help with affordability that's paid for through rates will affect the near poor. The household who is just over here is going to have, then their bill is going to be hit to try to make things more affordable. So you just have to be really conscious of these effects when we talk about utilities. We don't want the solution to make the problem actually worse, right? And we want to be really careful. There may be good reasons, by the way, to subsidize solar, electric cars, this, that, and the other thing. But maybe we should look at our other pocket, our tax pocket, for doing that, if that makes sense. You know, you don't always want to just be looking at the water customer as if they've got a target on their back. And I feel, frankly, that happens in some cases because, you know, they're going to pay their bills. Now, going back to prices, so those were expenditures versus prices. You kind of helped me, you know, get to this. So these are, you know, you all have heard about the Consumer Price Index, right? You hear everyone. In fact, U of M always does some good work on consumer willingness to pay issues and so on. So the consumer prices, that's our measure of inflation. That's the gray line in the middle. And then you can see telecom, you know, not very inflationary. Fuel, electric, gas, utilities, much more volatile because they're fuel commodity dependent. But look at the ones at the top, water, cable, and garbage. You know, environmentally driven one. Cable, you know, who knows what's going on there, right? But water, you can see, highly, highly inflationary, right? Why? So why are water prices going up so much? And here's a combination of the expenditure chart. Again, this one I actually did do the real prices plus the, nominal. So you can see this pressure on prices and pressure on the bill. You would sort of hope, because as we're becoming more efficient, you wouldn't see them going up as much. And so that's why we had a little bit of relief for a couple of years. But now we're seeing water bills creep up. I will say, though, that the study done at Michigan State by a colleague of mine, I thought overstated the issue to some extent. Now, this is just fun for journalists. Take a quick look. What's the headline say? It's kind of switching to usage now. Water use far outpaces population. What do you see? I was exactly wrong. This is population. So yeah, I grabbed a screenshot really quickly, you know, because that was a little bit of a gotcha, you know, funny moment. Because we're so used to thinking that everything goes up and up and up, and you know, water usage is flat. Water usage in the United States, water withdrawals have actually come down. And so this is an amazing success story. We have, and it's by virtue of the energy efficiency standards, all those new toilets, new fixtures of all kinds, new appliances. Everything in your house is using water more efficiently. And guess what? There's not really many new uses for water when you think about it. Now, again, not like electricity. I mean, people, you know, maybe you'll get a water fountain or something like that, but, you know, there's really, it's not the same. So there is an amazing success story happening in water that has gotten, I think, far too little attention. So here are total, you know, water withdrawals in the U.S. and the rate of change, for including public supply. So water use is on a per capita, and when I first noticed this, people thought I was nuts. I was that person in the back of the room going, I'm not sure it's really going up. And they said, no, you're wrong. These are very aggregate numbers, but they do indicate this. And there's a whole bunch of studies on individual cities, even in the desert cities, believe it or not, where they're seeing these gains. There are some examples, by the way. So water, to me, is at an inflection point where we've got, and why, again, I want to return to the point, to this idea about optimizing, re-optimizing systems. Because the last thing you want to do is build to, you know, water systems to yesterday's demand patterns. That'd be just really a wasteful use of resources. So there are people, smart people out there who run these algorithms. There's just a shot of one where they take all the piping data and they say, oh, well, actually you need to upsize over here, downsize over here, replace over here. And you thought you needed 10 million, you know you need 6 million. This is critical for water customers and affordability to be smart. All this work done over the years, people like Eric, people like me talking about efficiency, this will all be lost. Right, all the gains, if we don't actually make the decisions to actually build those avoided cost opportunities into our future infrastructure. Make sense? You know, because what is the point of all this efficiency if it doesn't matter to both capital and operating decisions? Okay, so here's a list of why are prices going up. There's capital costs, there's operating costs, there's the move to full cost pricing, because of the lesser availability of public funding for some of the infrastructure. And there's, to some extent, this flatter decline in demand. So lowering demand will, you'll have to raise prices just to get to the revenues that you need, but you will avoid costs in the long run. We do like systems to be self-sustaining. We like them spending to an optimal level to get a safe, compliant level of water. But we want them somehow coming up with revenues to cover that. And the question is how much of that has to come from rates, but could some come from other sources? Is that possible? A little bit on economics, I won't go into this, but, I can share this with you. If you're interested, obviously you don't want prices too low because, people will tend to be wasteful. They'll use more water and other resources than they should, but you don't want prices too high either. People engage in unhealthy, unsafe behavior, and it's largely unnecessary. You don't want people unnecessarily deprived and insecure under that situation. I won't go into this, but when we teach pricing, we talk about all these multiple criteria that we use in terms of financial and economic performance of the network itself. And then importantly, we have to start having this conversation about the social equity issues of both environmental stewardship and distributive justice. Now, we can't solve all of America's poverty problems through rates, right, and through utilities alone. Some of these go well beyond our sphere and call for that broader, discussion and sort of democratic solutions. But we also need rates that are understandable and feasible and especially legally defensible these days because we have people challenging every opportunity. So just a couple quick words about Flint. Their bills are excessive. This one, I think this is probably the current rate structure, although I'm not 100% sure. I live 40 miles away. I use probably actually about the same. I get the same bill for 3 months. So my water bill, my water and wastewater are about a third. It's just my husband and I, so we're pretty conservation oriented, but these rates are very, very high and very burdensome relative to population characteristics and rates of poverty. These are pretty obvious too. It's expensive to be poor, right? People struggle with their bills, with not just the bill itself, but deposits and the cost of connecting and disconnecting people. There's all kinds of consequences for individuals, and these are for all utilities. And of course, what we worry about, especially with water, is loss of child custody, loss of the home. These are really dire consequences, or even just forced moving. That's not a healthy situation either. And of course, these have social consequences for utilities and for society as a whole. Ignoring the problem doesn't make the cost or the problem go away, right? It just makes it somebody else's problem. So ultimately, you know, yeah, we do have to think about these things. So
that's a solemn to me.
Pardon?
It's a solemn to me. It's yeah. Time for questions.
Yeah. So, well, I think I've got like just two more. Okay. So let me. I won't go into these details, but I have to confess, I actually wrote a report on alternatives to disconnection in 1996. You know, so this is not a new problem. You know, the problem of people not being able to afford their service has been out there for a while. The rate that I'm playing around with. So I'm kind of giving you a sneak preview. I'm working on a paper right now. What I'd like to see is maybe a base charge that's not calibrated to usage, but calibrated to your property value. So something that would, you know, allow for a basic usage allowance based on public health criteria. I use 3,000 gallons per house per month. Again, calibrated to property value. Then you'd have your base usage on top of that, basic usage, and then discretionary use. And you could alternate. I've got a little spreadsheet model to show different ways of pricing this. The other thing I'd like to see is a service limiter or flow restrictor instead of disconnection. So at least you'd get some amount of water into that home, and you would not be in a situation of shutting people's water off. So how about this? How about we go out and have a contest maybe, get some of the foundations or others to fund a contest at the universities. We'll get Purdue on board. We'll get Wayne and U of M, MSU to go into the lab and build a tamper-proof affordable flow restrictor. That way, if somebody really, you know, if they can pay their bill, this will get their attention because they, you know, you'll just have that trickle of water, but it'll keep the house safe. You can make a pot of spaghetti. You can fill baby bottles. You can flush the toilet a couple times a day. I just think we need to put an end to water disconnection in this country, and we got to get smart technical people to help figure this out. So my last thoughts again, I don't think the issues in water are about or crises. I don't think they're as much about supply, infrastructure, technology. They're about governance, and that's why we've all got to continue to kind of work together on this. So, all right, I'll stop so we can at least have a few questions. Thank you.
Who has a question? Yes, can you repeat your name? The rules are for questions. SEJ members first, and working journalists. And please state your name and who you're with. So.
My name is Talia Beaver. I'm a reporter at ProPublica. I have two questions on for each of you. Andrew, are we at the point with the plastic pipe leaching situation where we're seeing like class action lawsuits or people kind of, you know, saying, hey, this is causing, you know, like the black lung essentially of, you know, kind of plastic inhalation sort of thing? So that's for you. And then Janice, you talked about kind of reoptimizing pipes in cities. So like take a city like Flint where you've lost a lot of population, and to reoptimize, you would say, okay, let's maybe get smaller diameter pipes. Would that then limit the city's capacity for growth and revitalization in the future? Because now they have less capacity in terms of water, so then you kind of are like pigeonholing them into this electrified state.
So, no, that's an excellent question. And, I mean, I think the current thinking in all infrastructure is to focus on flexible design and ways of, you know, accommodating both scenarios that you're describing, because I totally agree. You don't want to say, oh, this is it. This is, you know, we're not gonna ever grow. But I think, and maybe I actually want Andrew to help answer this, but I think you can accommodate that. So you'd really be talking about rebuilding, you know, for today, but you could potentially still accommodate growth with expansion of treatment plants and extension of pipes even. But again, we're using water so efficiently, and that trend's going to continue. And in fact, I think as you see the housing stock turnover, you'll benefit from those gains. Great question.
Just to follow up on your question, I had to type it so I remember it. So your question pertained to actions where we're at a point where we're seeing lawsuits and maybe things like black lung and stuff. So with regards to class action lawsuits, there was a class action lawsuit against the polybutylene manufacturers in the 1980s. There was a class action lawsuit against the PEX fitting manufacturers. There are class action lawsuits that are happening. I'm aware of individual settlements and non-disclosure agreements that have been established between companies and people affected. But one of the issues is you don't really understand the scale of the problem unless you have some centralized way to figure out how many circles there are on your map. And so it's decentralized, and there's forces trying not to centralize it, because once you centralize it, then you compile that information. With regards to the workers and the example that I showed you, so we briefed NIOSH before our paper was published and asked them what to do about it, and they said they had no knowledge that this was happening, and there's no NAICS code or anything associated with these workers, so professionally they didn't exist, but they were out there doing these things. So NIOSH is involved now, OSHA is aware of it, and so there's no formal testing. We called for a national testing effort to figure out biomonitoring and what they're exposed to. But that hasn't lifted off the ground at all. But I've had workers contact me and explain to me some of their issues and ask me for help, but there's no mechanism to help them. Yeah.
Yes?
Thank you for those presentations. It was very interesting. I was just wondering, what resources can journalists use to be able to digest this data and help bring it to the public in a digestible way? I know you could have the EPA a little bit, but apparently their information is all out of date.
You're hitting the nail on the head. I mean, we do not have adequate environmental and water industry data in this field, and I think we need to be pressing for it or find ways to collect it and clean it. The data that we do have that I've taken a close look at is just, it's not so good, you know, and so we're trying to wrestle with that, maybe make some recommendations of how they could, you know, improve their data collection process.
For buried pipes and infrastructure, there's big ticket numbers that you can cite and quote. The issue is, if you're looking at the plastics, it's even the civil environmental engineers that you talk to in your own city may have no knowledge of what they're dealing with. They're just doing what was shoveled to them, and they're just kind of moving forward with it. And it's saving like 90% of the cost sometimes on a fix for a pipe. We've posted a lot of things online. I had to take down my personal website because after we published this data, it got attacked and went down. So what we did was Purdue University set up a website, and I brought actually the first page of several papers here. So if you wanted to go find that, a lot of them are posted online. And if you call me, I'll talk to you. I talk to people who call me at 10 o'clock at night from Texas who are having problems with their plumbing. Anybody.
Yes, sir.
Hi, thank you again. I want to know how well you guys think cities are prepared for climate change in terms of their infrastructure for pipes in particular, because we've seen larger storm events, which leads to like huge sewage dumps because sewage overflows mm-hmm. because the city can't handle the amount of water that's coming. Are they getting better? Are U.S. cities doing their work on that, or is it just
So I'm glad you brought it up because I think wastewater costs and stormwater management costs are a big driver of that inflation. I think, you know, keep an eye out for insurance and credit rating agencies for the bigger cities, because you're going to have, they're starting to use this as a criterion in terms of if you're going to issue bonds or whatever. So in the absence of other regulatory forces, it may come from those sorts of weird areas. But some are getting it, and some are, you know, into adaptation strategies, and some are still maybe behind the curve, I would guess.
Some communities are under consent orders to separate their combined sewer, and they're using that as leverage to say the reason why certain technologies are needed. So we have these public health threats, but this is better. And therefore, that's the end of the discussion. And what I think we need to do is figure out, well, what do you mean it's better? Like, what are the consequences of that, if there are any?
Sir, from the start, Preston Munson, what kind of pipe does Purdue recommend for the distribution premise building?
So I do not speak for President Mitch Daniels. it all depends on the application. It depends on the conditions. So somebody will call me up and say, I have copper pipe with pinhole leaks. What should I use? And, well, what's in your community? Well, everybody has copper pipe with pinhole leaks, and they're getting rid of it. Well, don't install copper. So it all really depends on the application. And it's sometimes regionally specific, sometimes it's product specific. There have been class action lawsuits in certain parts of the country. So it really depends. And those,
it could be metal or it could be plastic.
It could be, yeah. It could be metal or plastic, yes.
We can go rapid fire.
Or you can talk down here, but we've reached the end of our time, and I was admonished strongly to get everybody downstairs at noon. So for those who are hungry, go.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you all.